Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Graham Hancock as we talk about Magicians of the Gods on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our final segment this hour with Graham Hancock as we take your phone calls as well. Graham, can this object be confused with what so many people have been talking about, a planet X that comes around every 3,600 years? Could it be this?
Well, there's an interesting relationship. I'm not aware of any good science that has a planet X coming around every 3,600 years. But there's excellent science on a planet X with a 10,000 or even 15,000 year orbit. That science, and it's, in other words, it's very far out, right at the extreme edges of our solar system. That science has resulted from measuring the effects on other planets. It's clear that there's some large object out there, very large, perhaps as big as Jupiter, which is whistling around on this huge orbit in the outer solar system. Now, that does relate to comets, because out there on the edges of the solar system, you have what is called the Oort cloud, which contains trillions of comets, many of them with diameters of hundreds of miles, giant comets. And the passage through the edges of the Oort cloud of this huge planet destabilizes those comets and can send comets swinging in into the inner solar system, where they can cross the orbit of the Earth and cause absolute chaos to humanity. And I believe that that these comet impacts have been a hidden hand in human history and help us to understand why, indeed, we are a species with amnesia.
Well, and these comets may have seeded us as well.
Well, this is another intriguing possibility. You're talking about the scientific notion called panspermia, which is that the molecules of life, the perhaps very basic bacteria, were brought here on comets. Comets do contain large amounts of ice as well as rock, and when they impact the Earth, the suggestion is that they brought microorganisms from elsewhere in the universe and started life on Earth. There's another theory, very intriguing, called directed panspermia, which was actually originally put forward by the Nobel Prize laureate Francis Crick, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on the double helix structure of DNA. Not many people know, because Francis Crick was very much a mainstream scientist, a Nobel Prize winner, but not many people know that he actually believed that life had been artificially implanted on Earth, and that it had come here in spaceships sent out billions of years ago by some advanced civilization on the other side of the galaxy that discovered its planet was going to be destroyed, sterilized perhaps by a supernova explosion. And Crick speculated that that civilization found they couldn't get themselves to another planet. The distances in interstellar space were too great, but that they could send the seeds of life out into the early universe. And his suggestion, it's in a book called Life Itself that Francis Crick published in 1981. His suggestion is that that was the origin of DNA on Earth, that actually it arrived here in an alien spacecraft from another galaxy. And there's an area where I do agree that we may well have had extraterrestrial input. If we go right back to the origins of life, to the creation of life on this planet, it is very mysterious. I mean, the Earth apparently forms about 4.5 billion years ago, which is 10 billion years after the Big Bang. And by the way, the Big Bang may just be a fairy tale as well.
I'm glad I heard you say that, by the way, because nobody can explain to me what it was.
No, exactly. I think it was Terence McKenna who used to say, you know, give me one fairy tale for free, give me one miracle for free, and I'll explain all the others.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's what the Big Bang is, you know. It's like a free miracle that science works with but never really explains. I mean, everything was contracted to the size of a pinhead and then suddenly explodes into a universe billions of light years across. It's a mind-boggling concept, and it is in a sense a fantasy. It may be a correct fantasy, but nobody knows. we have this this deep mystery at the heart of our origins. So Crick's suggestion, basically the panspermia suggestion, is life comes here on comets, not directed. Crick took that further. He talked directed panspermia. He felt that the DNA, RNA system did not have time to evolve naturally on Earth. And that it therefore must have been introduced from outside. And that's certainly an intriguing twist on the DNA story. And as I say, Crick wrote a whole book about it. So it's worth considering. And I'm certainly open to that aspect of alien involvement in the story of Earth. Perhaps life indeed was created by a vast civilization on the other side of the galaxy.
Could be. All right, let's go to the phones east of the Rockies. Angelo is with us from Reading, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Angelo.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I want to compliment your guest on realizing, as so many people don't, about ancient civilizations. They were, like a lot of people, considered them backwards. But
hardly on this one.
There was a program on television the other day where they say about how they, you know, how could they have possibly moved these giant stones to build the pyramids and stuff like that. And he had a thing, a block, a big block, that weighed, I forget how many thousands of pounds, and he had a wooden structure made that looked like camel humps, just one right after the other. And he gave it a slight push, and this block moved for like maybe 15 feet with just a push of a hand. And then he had a big concrete block that weighed, I forget how many tons, and he had it up on some stones in the center, and he had it like 6 inches away from the wall, and he gave it a push, and it went around a complete 360-degree circle, and then they measured it was 6 inches more away from the wall than what it started, gave it another push, moved it another 6 inches. So these people... And if you if people ever got the chance to go to Pompeii to see the things that then people did because they needed it, like that saying goes, necessity is the mother of inventions.
You bring up something interesting, Angelo, in terms of the size of some of these structures as well. Let's go back to Göbekli Tepe, Graham, for a moment. Again, how could they build things and move rock and structure like that?
Yeah, well, we need not get this entirely out of perspective. I mean, for example, there are existing megalithic cultures in Indonesia which are still moving 20-ton megaliths today. And they do so with relatively simple methods. It doesn't seem a mystery to them. Certainly megaliths in the range of 20 tons. It's when we get to megaliths of hundreds of tons and even of thousands of tons that we have a real problem in explaining how it was done. The enclosure wall surrounding the Temple of Jupiter at Baalbek, the Temple of Jupiter at Baalbek is a largely Roman and datable construction, but it is surrounded by a most mysterious megalithic wall, which is actually separate and freestanding from the Temple of Jupiter structure and doesn't look anything like it. And in that wall, you have three megaliths, each weighing more than 900 tons. Which, to give you the equivalent, that's roughly, 450 large SUVs?
Do we even have equipment that could move that today?
You know, we could move it today, but it would be incredibly difficult. It would take about 6 to 8 weeks to prepare for the lift. You would have to have very advanced equipment in order to do it. And then the next problem is that you're placing these blocks in such perfect juxtaposition to each other that you can't even get a sheet of paper in between the joints. And any modern engineer would say, why bother? I mean, you know, why bother using this huge stone when we can use lots of smaller stones instead? Why put ourselves to all this trouble? The only answer I can come to is that for the ancients, this must have been something they could do, that they had a technique, that they had methods for the manipulation of matter, for the lifting and moving and I also believe softening of stone, and that they used these techniques to create these structures that still boggle our minds today. We've gone down a particular route of science engineering. I would call it the root of mechanical advantage. We're very good at making machines, and we're always looking for machines in the past. This is one of the problems with the way we look at the past. Instead of looking at the past as a window which we can see through and into other things, we look at it as a mirror, and we want to see ourselves in the past. So we're looking for replications of our kind of technology in the remote past, when in fact it may have been a totally different system, perhaps harnessing the powers of the human mind, or perhaps harnessing the sound. There are many accounts of sound being used to lift these huge blocks. So I think that if we look to explanations in terms of our kinds of machines and material culture, we may not find what we're looking for. But if we're open-minded to the possibility that there are faculties of humanity that were harnessed in the past that we're not harnessing today, then I think we might find a great deal.
Indeed. Let's go next to Seattle, Washington. Paul's turn on Coast to Coast. Paul, go ahead. You're on with Graham Hancock.
Oh, well, thanks, George, for taking my call.
Sure.
It's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Hancock. I see you on Ancient Aliens. I want to ask you a couple quick questions. Would you think that Noah's Ark could have been like a DNA bank with like the DNA of everything on there?
That's a very interesting concept. I do go into that in Magicians of the Gods, actually, both in terms of Göbekli Tepe, which is very near to the mountains of Ararat, you know, where the Ark is supposed to be. And there are intriguing traditions which make it sound like a seed bank, an archive of material which has been prepared to restart something. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Okay, does that help you? He's gone.
Hello.
Okay, I think he's gone. Okay, but I think you answered his question, Graham.
I hope so.
Thomas in La Jolla, California. Go ahead, Thomas.
George, thank you for taking my call. Great interview, as always.
He's a good man.
And Graham Hancock, it's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you, sir.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, too.
I just saw, my question is about, I look upon it as a British concept, which is the idea of Earth energies,
mm-hmm.
ley lines.
Yes.
And it appears that the planet is crisscrossed by ley lines,
yes.
by these energy currents.
Yes.
To use a metaphor, it would be similar to, well, if you look at the human body, is crisscrossed by acupuncture mm-hmm. meridians.
Yep.
And is it possible that, this is a two-pronged question here, that the megalithic structures such as Göbekli Tepe and Giza Plateau, which is quite nearby,
mm-hmm.
Stonehenge, etc., the pyramids around the world, is it possible that they manipulate the ley lines like acupuncture needles
mm-hmm.
would manipulate the acupuncture meridians, the acupuncture
absolutely. You know, this is an excellent question, and you're touching on a key point, and it relates to the point I just made in the previous caller that we may be dealing with a system that we ourselves simply do not understand because it is so different from our mechanical reductionist kind of way of doing things. The notion that the ancients were harnessing the energies of the earth is an excellent idea, and there's a huge amount of evidence to suggest that this was at least one of the key functions of megalithic sites around the world, that they are related to the health of the earth and to the health of humanity upon the earth, and therefore we destroy them at our peril. I would say we are living in the midst of a gigantic worldwide system of harmonious functioning on earth, which we do not recognize. Our scientists are simply too blockheaded to be able to see it. That's the problem.
All right, Thomas, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Graham, we're going to come up to the break in a couple minutes, and then we'll come back with final phone calls. But As you look at all of these things here, when you call the book Magicians of the Gods, tell me about that, because you pick your titles very closely.
I do, indeed. And by the way, this is the paperback edition that's out now, and it's got three new chapters that were not there in the hardback edition, bringing the book thoroughly up to date in lots and lots of ways. Magicians of the Gods, because all around the world, there are traditions of the survivors of a cataclysm who had magical powers. They were seen to be magical powers. They could raise up stones, they could create crops, and so on and so forth. They taught writing, they taught astronomy, they taught the laying out of cities, and they were always referred to as the magicians of the gods. Sometimes they were called the Shining Ones, sometimes they were called the Apkalu, sometimes they were called the Shemsu Hor, sometimes they were Quetzalcoatl and his followers, but their core function was to bring civilization to the world after a great cataclysm, or rather to bring back civilization to the world, to restore what had been lost. These are the magicians of the gods, and that's why the book has that title.
Anything new that you're working on after this?
Yes, I'm working now. I've just begun, really. I've been working on it for some months, but I'm really getting into it now. A big new book on mysterious ancient America, which will be published in late 2018, probably, or early 2019. North America has been largely left out of the story of civilization, and I think the missing pieces of the puzzle are all there. We now have new DNA evidence, new archaeological evidence that puts back the human presence in the Americas by tens of thousands of years older than archaeologists previously believed. And you know, there's a vast story to tell, and the Native American traditions, the Native American star lore, the mound culture of the lower Mississippi and Ohio River valleys, just fascinating and intriguing material, and I'm getting into this in depth in my next book.
And Michael Cremo has talked about this over the years, too. He's a staunch believer in an older civilization.
Yes, absolutely. And again, like me, like John Anthony West, like Bavall, like Schock and others, Michael Cremo has come in for, you know, a vast amount of really horrible and unpleasant criticism from the archaeological establishment. We are involved in some kind of ideological battle here. What archaeology is primarily dealing with is an ideology of the past. And that ideology is based on the idea that we today are the apex and the pinnacle of the human story. And they just can't get their heads around the idea that there might have been an earlier civilization which rose high and was brought low, so low that it was almost completely forgotten.
And your critics come at you. Rather than just honest debate, they come at you, don't they?
Yes, very much the ad hominem attack. When they can't attack the idea, they attack the man in some way or another. Those of us who work in this field have got used to it. It is natural. It is the way things, you know, should be done to a certain extent. If ideas cannot withstand criticism, then there's probably something wrong with the ideas. Criticism is a good thing. It's good that those of us in the alternative history field do not all agree on everything. We are self-critical of one another, and it's good that academics criticize us as well, and that gives us a chance to respond to them and to show where we feel that the existing model of our past is utterly failing and that a new one is desperately needed.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take final phone calls with Graham Hancock, author of Magicians of the Gods. Okay, welcome back to our final segment. George Norrie here along with Graham Hancock, his latest revision of his work, Magicians of the Gods. He has updated that book, and he's updated it in a good way. Graham, it's amazing what this planet might have been capable of in terms of past civilizations. I think it's even possible they got to the moon way before we did.
I think it's possible too. The connections between the Earth and the Moon are very, very intriguing, and indeed the whole nature of the solar system is extremely bizarre. In fact, just being alive is bizarre when you come to think about it. Being a human being in a human body, living this life, it's just mystery. Everything is mystery. Anybody who says they've got it all taped and all sewn up and we understand it all, you know, they're just wrong. And that's, I suppose, one of the main problems I have with materialist reductionist science is that they have prematurely closed their accounts with reality.
There are many out-of-place artifacts that have been discovered over the years. As a matter of fact, I'm taping another year of Ancient Aliens tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're going to come and get you soon. And they're talking a lot about artifacts that seem to be millions and millions and millions of years old.
Yes, yeah. We have to be open to this possibility. The story that we have of intelligent life on this planet is a very limited, very narrow story reflecting a particular point of view. And it has excluded all other possible stories. And whenever there is a piece of anomalous evidence, mainstream science tries to dismiss it as a fraud or a hoax or some natural artifact or whatever. And I just think this is most unfortunate. It's a blinkered view which is leading us not to investigate our past. We desperately need to find out who we are and where we came from and what the human story is really all about. When you consider the geological forces, the floods, the ice ages, the earthquakes, the tsunamis, comet impacts with the Earth, all of these erosive, destructive geological processes have played a huge part in wiping the human record clean. But then we ourselves have played a part in that. I'm thinking of, for example, the Spanish when they first arrived in Mexico, the destruction of the Mayan codices, the deliberate burning of thousands and thousands of texts that might have given us insight into our past. This has gone on again and again. I'm afraid the Christian Church in its heyday played a huge role in the destruction of knowledge about the past, a huge, deliberate, purposeful role in making us forget our past. And I think that's very sinister. And I think that's why it's so important that we make this effort and recover our past. And it's why those of us who are working in the field of an alternative view of the human past, I do believe, have a role to play. And I don't think it's appropriate for academics simply to, you know, dismiss this whole field as lunatic fringe. There are a lot of very serious people working in this field. We feel strongly that the time has come for a complete review of the human past. But part of the reason we're so mixed up today is because we are actually deeply confused about our past.
Let's go back to the phones. Joshua in Grass Valley, California is with us. Hey, Joshua, go ahead.
Hey, first of all, I just wanted to say, my goodness, with this some snow that we've had, we would have been able to use that My Patriot Supply food.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
10 times this past month.
When that melts, there will be no drought up that way, that's for sure.
Oh, it's been amazing. And then next, I just wanted to say, Graham, hats off to you on your banned, quote-unquote banned, TED Talks video and your views on cannabis and ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. I am completely in awe of you. And then next, I want
to... Thank you for saying that, by the way. I felt it was important to share my personal story in that talk.
It was absolutely brilliant, and I absolutely share your view. And then next, I was just curious, how many different organizations, and are you willing to name any of them, or that you believe have some much more deeper insights into this information that we are not privy to?
Well, we can name a few, the Vatican, the Smithsonian, for example. I think there has been some deliberate concealment of evidence, very, very deliberate and purposeful, either the complete destruction of that evidence in terms of the burning and destruction of ancient texts, or perhaps the preservation and hiding away of those texts so that a particular story can be told, which would have to be changed if those texts were found. But I think a far bigger problem is the mindset of the archaeologists who work on the past. They come to the past with a preconceived notion about the origins of civilization, and they seem to find it very hard to see past that notion. They constantly try to fit everything into their existing theory rather than allowing new and anomalous facts to speak for themselves and perhaps changing their theory.
All right. Hey, thank you, Josh. I appreciate it. Next up, we go to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Michael's with us. Welcome to the show. Hi, Michael.
Hi, George. I called you before about the Mountain People, and then
I wanted
to talk to your guest today about my hypothesis. I believe more in an ancient human theory.
All right.
And that's so much the advanced Panspermia theory that he was talking about, I would go even further and say that we intentionally terraformed this planet at its first point of creation to create a multitude of different biodomes, because if we look at other planetary bodies, they usually exhibit one form of biodome. So the reason in terraforming this is so we could have a multitude of different biodomes to support a different multitude of different human species.
Very interesting idea. And I agree with you. Our planet is extremely puzzling, and it does appear to have been formed, worked upon in some way to make it ideal and conducive for life. And indeed, again, we come back to the relationship of the Earth and the Moon. You know, we would not have the life we have on this planet if it weren't for the Moon being the exact size and the exact place that it is. I mean, the Moon is a very mysterious thing. One example, we don't know the origin of the mile, the measure that we use called the mile. Its origins recede into the deepest prehistory, but the Moon is 2,160 miles in diameter. And that number, 2,160, which is a multiple of 72, crops up in ancient myths and traditions all around the world. So there's something very, very ancient, remotely ancient, a deep mystery in the preparation of the Earth for life that we also need to be looking much further into.
Okay, hey, thank you for that. Let's take a few more calls. The clock is going by quickly. Rich is an archaeologist in the Ozarks. Hey, Rich, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George, Graham.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey guys. I became friends of Michael Tellinger and Klaus Stoner years ago when my
good people. Good people.
Metal arrowhead embedded in a rock that the rock has formed around it.
And that rock must have been millions of years old, right?
Sorry, where is this arrowhead embedded in the rock? Sounds interesting.
Well, it's here. I mean, in the Ozark Mountains. I still own it. But
And the arrowhead is made of what substance, do you know?
It's hematite.
Hematite.
It's very similar in appearance to the London Hammer.
Right.
Yes.
Carl Baugh has in Texas. But what I was trying to get to was back to the subject of the Moon. When my son found the arrowhead that the rock had formed around, we became very obsessed in the creeks, and I found a cranial fossil of what I thought was a human. And sent images of it to the University of Washington, where Kennewick Man is housed.
Indeed.
And they told me that the cheekbone of it was not a human characteristic. It went out the back of the skull like a fin. And I found in ancient glyphs humans that had this horn that comes out the back of the head. You can even find it on newspaper rocks in Moab. All around the world, I've been able to find these human skulls that have a fin that comes out the back of the head.
Well, what you're saying is you found images of them, but you yourself found an actual skull or a bit of a skull.
Exactly. I've got a sandstone skull. They say that the sediment itself is somewhere in the neighborhood of 650 million years old.
Wow.
Okay.
A picture of that.
So the University of Washington tells me that this is not a human characteristic. Well, after that, my fiance and I were obsessed in the creeks, and we started finding hundreds and thousands of human faces that had been sculpted in the stones that had this characteristic carved into it. One day we were looking through a National Geographic, and my girlfriend jokingly hands me this picture that had come back from the Moon. They brought it back on Apollo, I don't know, 12. It was from the 1970s. In this group of photographs that had come back from the Moon,
You should publish your findings.
I have found
with photographs and images, because when we talk about images on the radio, it becomes difficult. What we need is to actually see the images. Have you published your findings anywhere?
No, I've been working on a book for 8 years,
I wish you joy with it.
You got to get this done. Get this done. We'll help you, Rich. I mean, that would be something. That kind of that was part of the artifacts we were talking about earlier, Graham. How these strange things will occur. They find little metal spheres down where you know the area was millions of years old, untouched by a human. I mean, how does this happen?
Exactly. And these out of place artifacts. Why are they called out of place? They're called out of place because of the rigid story of our past that has been told and taught to us by archaeologists and historians. They're only out of place if that story is true. But if that story is not true, or if that story is fundamentally flawed, as I believe it to be, then these out-of-place artifacts aren't out of place at all. They're clues to the real story of our past. Much more attention needs to be paid to them, and kudos to Michael Cremo for, you know, his fantastic book, Forbidden Archaeology, which really gives just a huge amount of chapter and verse on these artifacts.
We've got Max in Manhattan, Kansas now. Hello, Max. Thank you for calling.
Hi, George. Hi, Graham. How you doing?
Great.
Hi. Doing good, thank you.
I'm an avid reader of your work, Graham. I've read several of your books, Down Under and Underworld, and several of the others. Also, Robert Bouval and John
thanks
Anthony.
Thanks for reading us.
Read a lot of that stuff. But I've got a question that I don't know if I haven't heard it raised in the scientific community.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the precession.
Yes, and the precession. The precession, the wobble on the axis of the Earth that causes the pole star to change and that causes the zodiacal constellation that rises behind the sun on the equinox to change, and these changes unfold at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. So we pass through one house of the zodiac, effectively one astrological age, every 2,160 years, which weirdly is the diameter of the moon in miles.
Graham, when do you think this comet, if it comes back, will come back?
Well, it comes back every year. This is the alarming fact that the group of 30 geophysicists, now joined by quite a number of prominent astronomers such as Victor Klube and Bill Napier, are making, that we are dealing with the debris stream of a fragmented giant comet, at least four fragments of which hit the Earth with cataclysmic effect 12,800 years ago, but further fragments, some of them perhaps even a mile or miles wide, continue in orbit in the Taurid meteor stream, which is a known and recognized meteor stream, which we pass through twice a year. The calculations of Emilio Spedicato, a mathematician working with this group, have suggested that there may be one object in the Taurid meteor stream that is as much as 30 kilometers, about 20 miles in diameter. That would be an earth-killing impact.
Oh, my God,
That would be absolutely devastating. And this is not about doom and gloom. We have the technology to sweep our cosmic environment clean. We do not need to face another impact in the future. If we were to choose as a global community to focus on this problem now, we could make our cosmic environment completely safe for a cost that is far, far, vastly less than the money we spend every year on weapons of mass destruction to horribly, technologically murder one another.
Well, the wall alone is going to cost $10 billion, they're estimating.
An unbelievable expenditure, which should be spent on making the Earth safe, this precious planet, this gift from the universe to humanity that we are privileged and loved by the universe to live upon. The way that we are behaving on this planet, our mutual hatred and fear and suspicion, the vast investment in weapons of mass destruction, and our complete blindness and obliviousness to the dangers that we are creating, the pollution of our environment, the wreckage of Mother Earth, and the cosmic environment filled with asteroids and comets, which we can do something about. When we speak of comets coming back, it is not gloom and doom. This is a problem we can solve.
We sure can. Graham, thank you so much for being on the program. I look forward to running into you at Contact in the Desert this year. For Dan Galante, Mike Cosio, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burles, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then. Be safe, everyone.